Our title today is The King's Words. We are studying different aspects of the topic of Christ our righteousness that are often misunderstood. More recently, we're studying about justification by faith and how it relates to the third angel's message. For the Spirit of Prophecy tells us that they are one and the same thing. If you recall the study of a couple of weeks ago, we were discussing about authority and obedience, very bad words to most people nowadays. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary tells that to obey is to be ruled or controlled. That's bad, isn't it? To be obedient, says, is submission to control, restraint, or command. So when you obey, you're being controlled, you're being ruled, dominated. And obedience means that. In Romans chapter 6:16, this is a very important topic concerning righteousness, for we're told, "Know ye not that to whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death, or of obedience unto righteousness." That our destiny is determined by the one we become servants to obey. As we discussed a couple weeks ago, all obey. Not all obey God, but all obey someone, some authority. Sin is really obedience to someone else other than God. So all are obeying. And as Paul is teaching here, that whomever we yield ourselves servants to obey, his servants we are, whether sin unto death or obedience unto righteousness. So righteousness is the result of serving the right ruler, the right leader. Often we have a different concept of righteousness than that. Now, this is not a forced or legislated type of obedience as we usually think about it. For in the book Mount of Blessings, page 18, it says, "Righteousness is love." And just briefly going through some quotations, page 46 of Mount of Blessings, "Obedience is the surrender of the heart to the sovereignty of love, the kingship, the rule of love. A surrender of the heart to that kind of rulership, the sovereignty of love." Page 60, "Steps to Christ, obedience is the service and allegiance of love." And so the motivation for serving is vastly different than in all other kingdoms or all other realms of life. It's not something exacted of us or demanded. The Lord woos us by his love and wins us to his side so that by love we're motivated to serve him. This is a different kind of obedience, a very delightful work and activity. So often we made it an irksome thing. That is not the kingdom of Christ at all. Righteousness then is a result of serving the King of righteousness. And so Jeremiah 23 verse 6 calls him the Lord, our righteousness, the Master, the ruler, our righteousness. He rules us in righteousness, and by serving him in love, we become righteous. Righteousness is actually serving the right leader, the right king. And too often we think it's trying to do something that's right. Now this makes the choice of kings very, very vital to the Christian life. And unfortunately we haven't thought that we had a choice often, or haven't realized that we could serve different kings. Mainly, we're concerned about what when we discuss righteousness. What is righteousness? But in this context, we're concerned about whom in righteousness. For righteousness is determined by whom we serve, not what we do. The what is important. I'm not leaving that out at all. But of primary importance is the whom. And you say, I don't quite understand that. When Paul came to Athens and preached there in Acts 17, in verse 23, he said, "I see that you serve an unknown God." He went on to make God known to them. For Jesus taught in John 17:3, "This is life eternal, that you might know God, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom he sent." So it's life eternal to know him. To serve an unknown God is not to know how to serve. It's impossible. We must know him to serve him aright. So the acquaintanceship with God is most important. It's not just the what. It is also whom we serve. Now if you know him, then you will love him. Is that what 1 John 4, 7-8 teaches to us? If you know him, you'll love him, because God is love. And Romans 13, 10, love is the fulfilling of the law. So you see, to know him is to serve him aright. Then you'll love him, and love is the keeping of the law. It's fulfilling of the law. So the knowledge of God, the knowing him, the serving him, because we know him, because we love him, because he is love, this produces righteousness by a ruler. And by a willing, loving submission to a ruler of love. A vastly different thing than we often think about it. So it's not just the what in righteousness.
It's whom we serve. This makes all the difference. When Jesus came to this earth, born in Bethlehem, he came as a king to rule. We often think he will come someday to rule. He has come to rule. In that marvelous verse, Isaiah 9, verse 6, the government shall be upon his shoulder, the one who is born to us as a son, as a child. He will rule. He does not rule in glory at this time, but he rules in grace. The wise men from the east said, where is he that's born king of the Jews? They knew he'd come to rule. And after they saw his humble birth, they were tempted to doubt, but they knew he was the king. And they bowed before him and gave him gifts fit for a king. He came preaching in Matthew 4:17, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's right here. My kingdom has come. Come and be subjects of my kingdom, is what he was really saying. Now, he did not establish the kingdom of glory. That's future in his second coming. But he did establish the kingdom of grace at his first advent. And he has been ruling ever since. And so the prime question is, are you subjects of his kingdom? Every member of the church professes to be his subjects, but we don't call it that. We call it membership in a church. And we say, because I'm a member of church, I have to do this and so on, I can't do this. Does your church allow you to do this, they ask us? It's not our church. It's what does your king ask you to do? Isn't that right? Doesn't matter what the church says. What does the king want, you know? Are we all subjects of the king? The king's in command. We do what the king says. Not because we have to, but because we decided to serve him. What does the king say? That's the important thing, isn't it? Then what you think is what he says. Because we're ruled by a king. Don't have to be ruled by him. It's your free choice. So different than other kinds of servants in other kingdoms where there's a forced submission or you're put into jail or is killed or something like that. His is not like that. His is a free choice. Serve me if you choose. I'll do everything I can to win you. I want you to be mine. Serve me because you love me. And so by his love, we love him in return, and therefore because we love him, we keep his commandments and serve him. Now some people say, how can he rule? He isn't here anymore. Most kings rule like that. Kings don't go all over their countries to visit all the people every day to rule. They rule in absentia. Very few people in the kingdom ever saw a king before television. But they were ruled by the king. How did he do it? Well, he had helpers, administrators under him. And he ruled through his laws. And through his decrees and commands. Through his words, you might call them. And wherever his word and law was, the king was ruling. And there were people there to administer his laws. The king always ruled by his word or his decree. And the king's words were very important in any kingdom in this world today and in the days of bygone years. Now, he has left us his word. The king still rules by his word. We have it. And most people have it in their own language today. Almost everyone has their own language. So the king still rules. We know exactly what he wants, what his desires are, what his plans are. His wishes, what he's like, we can know him through his word and through his representatives, and so we have adequate opportunity to serve him knowledgeably, intelligently. And so our king has been ruling through his word for a long, long time and through his administrators. Now, as soon as this king was born, his rulership was contested. When the wise men asked Herod, where is he born, king of the Jews, he went to inquire about this king of the Jews, found out where he'd be born. When the wise men did not come back, he established a decree to kill all male children under 2 years of age. He didn't want any competitors. In Revelation chapter 12, a famous chapter of Seventh-day Adventist, the antagonist who didn't like the rule of Christ was really not Herod. He was but a symbol of a more terrible enemy than Herod. Revelation chapter 12, verses 2, 4, and 9. And she being with child cried, travailing in birth, and pain to be delivered. Skipping to verse 4, speaking of the dragon, his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And verse 9 tells that dragon was Satan. He's the one that did not want Christ to rule. He has a lot of friends today, doesn't he? Even in the church. Many, many Christians don't want Christ to rule. And they have a very strong, staunch advocate of not wanting Christ to rule in Satan. He never wanted Christ to rule. So if you're anti-authority of Christ and his rulership, you've joined forces with Satan. That's his idea. He's always been an antagonist of Christ. Now, this was made very plain in the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. In the third temptation in Matthew chapter 4, Satan makes it very plain why he doesn't want Christ to rule. Verses 8 to 10 of Matthew 4. Again, the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he saith unto him, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. In the Luke chapter 4, it says, these kingdoms are all delivered unto me. They're mine. As though God had given them to him. Then Jesus said unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. God is in charge, not you. That's what he was saying to him. Satan claimed the ownership of all the kingdoms of this world 2,000 years ago. He still claims ownership. Doesn't he? He still claims all these kingdoms are his, and all the inhabitants are his. He claims they are his. He says they belong to me because I've conquered all human beings. They've all sinned. They're all mine. They belong to me. Unfortunately, too many people believe him. And so he claims to dominate us because he's overcome us. Now, his rulership has some strings attached. He doesn't mention that, and Desire of Ages, page 129 and 30 are excellent, and you ought to read them about the kingship of Christ and the kingship of Satan. When Satan declared to Christ, the kingdom and glory of the world are delivered unto me, and whomsoever I will, I give it. He stated what was true only in part. He always tells half-truths. He stated what was true only in part. And he declared it to serve his own purpose and deception. Satan's dominion was that wrested from Adam. But Adam was the vicegerent of the Creator. He represented him. He was the vicegerent of the Creator. His was not an independent rule. The earth is God's, and he has committed all things to his Son. Adam was to reign subject to Christ. When Adam betrayed his sovereignty into Satan's hands, Christ still remained the rightful king. Thus the Lord had said to King Nebuchadnezzar, the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, Daniel 4:17. Satan can exercise his usurped authority only as God permits. When the tempter offered to Christ the kingdom and glory of the world, he was proposing that Christ should yield up the real kingship of the world and hold dominion subject to Satan. Now you have to remember this. In the very beginning, back in the garden, as soon as Satan saw that Adam had rulership, he said, that's what I need. Then I'll dominate all his successors, all mankind, because I'll lead them all to sin when I get the father of all mankind. What he did not acknowledge, of course, is that this was all subject to Christ. This was not an independent rule that Adam had, and so Satan doesn't have it either. He must listen to what Christ has to say about this. And so Satan sought immediately to take control as soon as Christ was born. He's always done that, contesting about the kingdom and about the rulership of mankind. Now this contest, this great controversy between Christ and Satan, as we've often called it, and as the book so accurately calls it, is more clearly seen under the symbol of the King of Babylon. Remember now we're studying justification by faith under the third angel's message where it discusses Babylon? So you must discuss the King of Babylon, you discuss Babylon. Otherwise you cannot possibly understand this all about. The King of Babylon is discussed in Isaiah chapter 14. And I want you to notice that he's the same individual that tried to devour the Christ child as soon as he was born. Isaiah 14, and first of all, verse 4. Thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon, and say, how hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased? How has Babylon come to its end or fallen? And he goes on and discusses Babylon through all the succeeding verses. And down there in verse 12, how art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? He's talking about the king of Babylon. If you read all the context. Lucifer is termed and symbolized by the king of Babylon. How have you fallen, you see? How have you been cut down to the ground? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation, the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And the word is Most High. So he aspires to the pinnacle of authority and rulership. You can read down how he'd be brought down to hell to the size of the pit, so on and so forth. But finally, in verses 22 and 23, "For I will rise up against them, saith the Lord of hosts, and cut off from Babylon the name, the remnant, and son and nephew, saith the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the bittern, pools of water, and I will sweep it with a besom or broom of destruction, saith the Lord of hosts." I'll destroy this place. Here is the aspirations of Lucifer. He said, "I want to rule, I want to dominate, just like God. I aspire to everything that he has." So when the Christ child was born, he was very suspicious, and he said, "Somehow I must get rid of this individual. He will compete with me. I dare not trust him." He didn't succeed when he was born, so he tried in the temptation in the wilderness. He was always trying to get rid of Christ's kingship. Until finally Christ described him as he worked with the Jews, but they said, "We'll not have this man to reign over us." You know how angry the Jews were when Pilate had put up that sign, "The King of the Jews." Always denying this. And they chose Barabbas, a criminal, over Jesus as king. Gives you some idea of all the controversy engaged between Christ and Satan as they indulged in their activities over rulership. For Satan came to dominate men. He knows that he must dominate us in order to prevent us from being saved. That if we ever won to Christ, that his cause is lost. That we will become righteous because we serve a righteous king. And more than we realize it, he understands it. Now we come to the day and age where we despise authority. Almost everyone, not just the young, are anti-establishment. And we like this, and we think it's worthy and good thing to do. And all the devil wants is feelings of anarchy in our systems. Just rebellion. To where we will never submit or never subject ourselves to any authority. That's exactly what he wants. And today we see the results of this emphasis in the attitude of children toward parents. Parents toward grandparents. The young toward the aged. The employees toward the employers. Citizens toward government. You just go on and on. Students toward teachers and faculty. Members toward pastors and conferences. Everywhere it's just rampant. You see this anti-authority attitude. In some cases it's justified. But such a widespread anti-authoritarian attitude pleases the devil no end because it makes us all rebellious. And anti-submissive. That's a terrible thing. And we all rebel against it. We want to be subject to no one. It's destroying marriage because there's no subjection in marriage anymore at all. But the Bible teaches there must be. Not enforced subjection. A willing, loving subjection. And so we have thousands of divorces because no one likes authority. Everyone wants to do his own thing. No one wants anyone to tell him what to do. The war is coming down to its climax as we see this rebellion, this anarchy, sweeping all over the land and throughout the world as nation rises against nation, as evidence this is taking place. Now, the king of Babylon is an unusual person, and you begin to understand some of his activities as you study the king of Babylon in Daniel chapter 2, famous chapters to Seventh-day Adventists. But somehow I think we've missed some things there. We really haven't understood what Daniel is saying in some of these verses. Remember, we're still talking about Lucifer. He's depicted and symbolized in the activities of the king of Babylon, for he's termed that by Isaiah the gospel prophet. You know the dream of the image there in Daniel chapter 2? You know it very, very well, most of you. Notice some of the conclusions about that in Daniel 2 verses 37 and 38, the very heart of it. "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory." He had many kingdoms under him, Nebuchadnezzar. But he said, "To you who are the king of kings, the God of heaven has given your kingdom. You did not develop it and conquer it. He's given it to you as an outright gift. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all." Who did? God has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. And as Nebuchadnezzar thinks about it in verse 47, he said, "Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings. I might be a ruler over other kings, but he is a Lord, a master of kings. He is a God of all gods." Now this is the heart of the book of Daniel, and it has much to do with Revelation. Nebuchadnezzar liked everything about the dream, except that the God who would raise up kings could also take them down. It reminded Nebuchadnezzar there would come another kingdom after him, and he didn't like that. So he had them build an image all of gold, not merely the head, but the whole body, from the top to the toes, you see, showing that his would be an everlasting kingdom, that God would nevermore raise up another kingdom after him. Now he was in contest, a combatant with God, who'd given him the kingdom, and said, there's someone coming after you. To guarantee no one come after him, he had all his rulers gathered together to bow down and worship this image, assuring there'd be no rebellion, no coup d'etat in his kingdom. And all bowed down except three. And you know the story very well there in Daniel chapter 3. So now the king would take care of them. The king's words, by his decree, he would destroy them because they would not honor him. Now he was in contest not with three men, but with a God whose decree he was trying to countermand by the image all of gold. God said only a head of gold. The king said all of gold. God said that's not the way it is. Who is in authority? Which is the King of Kings? So when he saw one like the Son of Man with the three Hebrews, you know, he discovered that someone was greater than he was. And there in Daniel chapter 4, he makes it very, very plain in verse 28 what had happened. Then Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel 3:24, spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word. The law of the Medes and Persians, the law of the Babylonians was unchangeable. He's changed the king's word. This meant that there was some authority much greater than the king of Babylon to countermand his word. And now he was having a little difficulty with a superior force. He acknowledges it here. But after a while he forgets and changes his mind. Daniel chapter 4. And you know the story there just as well as you know this one. Daniel 4, he says in verse 30 of that chapter, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power? God didn't give it to me. I built it, you see. And for the honor of my majesty, not for his majesty, but for mine. So now he does no longer acknowledge that the King of Kings has given him his kingdom. He said, it's mine, it's for me. The result is, of course, a terrible humiliation. He became like a beast. Why did he become like a beast? You must read it very carefully, you'll miss it. Verse 25 of Daniel 4. They shall drive thee from men. Thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee eat grass as oxen. They shall wet thee with dew of heaven. Seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Till you know this, not just understand, not just realize, not just acknowledge, till you know it, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, today and then as well, that he gives it to whomsoever he will. It's his choice, not popular demand. God raises up and God takes down. You do not vote them into power. You only think you do. Right? You only think you do. You don't, really. It's always been this way. God is in charge. You're not in charge. I'm not in charge. A party is not in charge. They've never been in charge. They only thought they were. This king thought he was. God doesn't operate a democracy. I know that's a little shocking to those of us in the United States. He doesn't. He operates a kingdom. And he is the selector of those kings. The rule of this earth, too. The kings of the world belong to him, not to Satan. Satan claims them. God says they're mine. When Satan tries to dominate this world through the king of Babylon, he said, you can't. They're mine. I've given it to you. You honor me and you may stay there. If you don't honor me, you can't have it. I'll get somebody else. And especially the experiences of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus and Darius are made very, very plain that God is the one who raises up and takes down from the throne. He's the one in charge. And we may have to understand this very well, better than we have in the past. Now, whether it's in Babylon or in the church, Satan is always trying to get God off the throne by one method or another, and too often we cooperate with him. Originally, God was the king of Israel, a symbol of the church as a nation. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12, you can read this, where it describes Israel's experience in desiring a king. We have some problems with this today that we really haven't studied quite carefully enough. Verse 12 of 1 Samuel 12, "When he saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, he said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king." When the Lord your God was already your king, I could say. He was your king. In Judges chapter 8 and verse 23, another man talks about this subject. "And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." They want to make him king after a successful battle. He said, "I'm not going to rule over you, and my son is not going to rule over you either. The Lord will rule over you. God is your king." How much difficulty we have in understanding this. The Lord had ruled his people through prophets as he spoke by them down through the centuries. As he gave his commands and his words, the prophet spoke for God. For a prophet is one who speaks for another. A prophet of God speaks for God. So the prophet came with his messages, and he was coming here through Samuel. Tell him exactly what God desired his people to do. They refused the prophet, they refused God. They rejected the prophet, they rejected God, as he makes very plain to Samuel here in chapters 8 to 12. Now the people desire to be like other nations. Another way of saying that, they desire to be like the world, just as we do today. The other nations had kings, and they were very successful sometimes, and they said, "We want a king as they have." So Samuel went to God and 1 Samuel chapter 8, 4 to 7, told him about this. He said, "Remind them what will happen when men rule over them. How they'll be oppressed. How they'll be enslaved. How they have to pay taxes and all sorts of things. Very miserable things." And when he finished the whole talk, the words of God, they said, "We still want a king." And God said, "All right, give them a king." But he gave them a king under certain conditions. Many think that God no longer was ruler after a man became king. The Bible doesn't teach that. If you read it very carefully in 1 Samuel, it doesn't teach that at all. The Spirit of Prophecy elaborates on it at quite great length. I want to give you some of the counsel found there. Page 611, Patriarchs and Prophets. "Samuel then set before the people the manner of the kingdom, stating the principles upon which the monarchical government was based, by which it should be controlled. The king was not to be an absolute monarch." He was not to be that. "But was to hold his power in subjection to the will of the Most High." There was someone over him, you see. And to make that very plain, God chose the king himself. In fact, he always chose the king. When they tried to choose their own king, he would overrule. And he was always putting himself in charge of raising up kings and taking them down. On page 603 of Patriarchs and Prophets, it tells you about his reign, how it's controlled. "The government of Israel was administered in the name and by the authority of God. The work of Moses, of the 70 elders, of the rulers and judges, was simply to enforce the laws that God had given." They did not make the laws. See, he did. "They had no authority to legislate for the nation." The laws were always God-given, not man-inspired or man-given, you see. "This was and continued to be the condition of Israel's existence as a nation, always ruled by God," you see. "From age to age, men inspired by God were sent to instruct the people to direct the enforcement of the laws. The Lord foresaw that Israel would desire a king, but he did not consent to a change in the principles upon which the state was founded. The king was to be the vicegerent of the Most High. God was to be recognized as the head of the nation. His law was to be enforced as the supreme law of the land." So even after they had a king, God was still in charge. Now, why did he not want a man to rule? Why did he want to be over the king? This is made plain on page 606, and it's the most important part. God desired his people to look to him alone as their lawgiver and their source of strength. Looking unto Jesus. When on the Mount of Transfiguration and finally all disappeared, they saw no man save Jesus, the Bible says. Only Christ was left. And the Lord said from heaven, "Hear ye him." Just listen to him. He wanted people to look to him solely. Feeling their dependence upon God, they would be constantly drawn near to him. They'd become elevated and ennobled, fitted for the high destiny to which he had called them as his chosen people. When a man was placed upon the throne, it would tend to turn the minds of the people from God. They would trust more to human strength and less to divine power. and the heirs of their king would lead them to sin and separate the nation from God. The Lord knew what he was doing. Let's suppose they all followed King Saul. Wouldn't that have been a tragedy? There'd have been no survival of anyone. The whole kingdom had been destroyed unless God had been over King Saul to overrule when he went down, 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 to put another king in his place. Now, the unique thing about this kingdom is that during all the reign of the kings of Israel and of Judah, God was in charge, and he manifested his authority by speaking to the king through a prophet. God was always directing the king and therefore the nation through prophets. Some of the kings listened to the prophets. Some of them despised the prophets. But this is how God took charge of his kingdom when he had a human king over them. Now you can imagine what happened when King Saul went down to the witch of Endor and listened to a prophet of the devil. He was saying, I don't want the Lord to tell me what to do. I'll gladly let the devil tell me what to do. Now you can understand Revelation 12:17, where it says that the dragon or Satan is angry with the remnant of the church, the woman. He goes to make war with the remnant of her seed, which do what? Keep the commandments of God and have what? The testimony of Jesus. And Revelation 19:10 tells us the testimony of Jesus, the spirit of prophecy. Why does that make the devil furious? Because they're listening to the voice of God through the prophet. This means that God is ruling them. They not only keep his commandments, but they listen to his directions through his prophet. This made Satan furious. So he wars against them. That's what the Bible says. He doesn't want anyone to be subject unto God. He wants to rule in the place of God. I will be like the Most High. So this very moment, he's doing everything he can to prevent you from listening to the king. This is why we have so much trouble about the gift of prophecy. It isn't your logic that gives us so much trouble. I know you use it all the time. But it's our selfishness. It's the devil deceiving us and tempting us. He doesn't want anyone to listen to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He wants everyone to listen to him. This is why there's so much controversy about the law, even in the Adventist church. The controversy is not all outside of the church, much of it inside. About obedience, tremendous controversy about that. Spirit of prophecy, these are two of the hottest subjects we have in the whole denomination. Why? The devil is angry. He doesn't want anyone to listen to the voice of God. Not at all. That would deprive him of subjects. That would deprive him of victory. That'd be a certain death for Satan. He still claims and has hopes, you see, of conquering everyone. And so he goes on and on in his campaign. You can also see why in the last days he'll have many false Christs, false rulers, that means. Many false prophets, false voices of God. It's a necessity, you see, for Satan to keep us from serving the right one. If you ever serve the right one, you'll have life. The devil will be whipped. You'll be successful. So all these things are the devil's invention these days to keep us from possibly serving King Jesus, I may call him that, the King of God's people. When he finds you obeying the commandments of God, truly obeying them, not just professing, listening to the directions of his prophet, his voice, it frightens him, and wars take place in a hurry. Now in Babylon, modern Babylon, we still have the same issues. In modern Babylon, she rules or reigns over the kings of the earth. Read Revelation 17:18. She claims to be a king of kings, a ruler of rulers, a lord of lords. Revelation 17:18. Reigneth over the kings of the earth. By the way, for centuries she's claimed to set up kings, has she not? And to tear them down. This is demonstrated by many stories in history in bygone years. Still is true this very day, and will become more true as we come near the end of time. Satan has always had a beast or a kingdom reigning in Revelation, if you notice. A beast is a kingdom because he wants somebody to rule over the people of this world. And the beast is so successful, they ask, who is able to make war with him? The Bible answers in Revelation 7, 17 and 19, where it shows Christ coming on a white horse. So these powers make war with him, and he is King of kings and Lord of lords. There's a contest over who is the King of kings. Babylon says they are. The Lamb of God in Revelation 17 says he is. Revelation 17 says he conquers them, establishing he's King of kings and Lord of lords. And when he comes in Revelation 19, read some of those verses. When he sits on his throne ruling in all his glory, it says he'll have a name on his vesture, King of kings and Lord of lords, in your Bibles in capital letters. And yet prior to that time, the devil wants to make sure you're not saved. So in volume 5 of the commentaries, page 1106, Satan will not only appear as a human being, but he'll personate Jesus Christ. And the world that has rejected the truth will receive him as the Lord of lords and King of kings. The world that has rejected the truth will receive him, Satan, as the Lord of lords and King of kings. He'll actually come with the same profession of Nebuchadnezzar. I'm over all the earth. There's no king like unto me. Every king is subject unto me. I am the one who raised them up and tears them down. I am the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And the devil have claimed to have arrived at that status when he comes impersonating the coming of Jesus. Friends, this is not a game. This business of ruling and being subjects of a king, it's not a game. We look at it often, you know, as something we can play with today or tomorrow, make up my mind, or some other time. We have very peculiar ideas about this kingship and being in submission to a ruler. The devil knows it's a game of life and death. And the Lord knows it too. And unfortunately, the church hasn't discovered it yet. In this day and age when the devil aspires to establish that he is King over all the earth, the King of kings, we can't even tell when we serve him and when we serve Christ. We can't even tell. And many argue when they're serving Satan that they're serving Christ. In the church, they argue this. And yet they profess to know him whom to know is life eternal. Do you begin to understand this obedience thing? This authority, this rulership, it's so different, you know. We've envisioned as someone telling us what to do, and we don't like that. It's someone always picking on us, and we say, get off of my back, let me alone. That's not the problem at all. It's nothing like that. This is a church inventing rules and all sorts of things that give you an appearance of righteousness like a Pharisee. That's not what the problem is. There are two kings vying for your allegiance, your loyalty, your service. Two. It's a fight unto death for us and for them. Is it not? Unto everlasting life or everlasting death. We may choose whom we can serve, but we must know whom we serve. We do not serve an unknown God. The heathen do, but we do not. If we do not know Christ, we can never know Satan. If you can't tell the difference, it simply means you don't know Jesus. But his book makes him very, very plain. Extremely plain. And he's planning that before he comes the second time that his saints will make it obvious who are the righteous and who are Christ-like or God-like. So that every human being will know what it's like to be like Jesus. And Christ is counting on you and me to demonstrate to the world what it's like to be like Jesus. It's the most important thing. We can never be like Jesus while we try to do it by ourselves. We can never be like Jesus while we don't even know him. We can never be like Jesus by trying to do what is right. We can only be like Jesus by obeying him and doing what he says. And that's so different from just the what. For he's a very humble person. A very self-denying, a self-effacing, a self-renouncing, a self-sacrificing, a meek and lowly one. Come unto me, all you that labor heavy laden, I will give you rest. He was so different from the proud, ambitious, prestigious, worldly-seeking, sophisticated, intellectual. So different. Self-forgetful, totally. Mindful of only of others and their needs. And coming to serve and to bless and to love and to demonstrate that love. And the world will never know God until Christians obey the King of Righteousness because they love Him. And they love Him because He first loved them. And they will say to all the world, "Behold your God. See Him in us." As the Apostle Paul said, "For me to live is Christ." And the Christian church will say, "God is like this." And they will demonstrate the loving, forgiving, merciful, sacrificial acts of Christ to all the world. Jesus waiting for this. The devil says it will never happen. Humans won't be like that. They'll be as selfish as I am, as greedy as I am. And I can have them all. You see, the devil claims that we're his yet because we've all sinned. And the Bible teaches in 2 Peter that of whom a man is overcome, of the same is he brought in bondage. Since Satan has overcome us, the devil says, "You're mine." But he always tells half-truths. For Christ said he's the father of liars, the originator of them. For the truth is that Christ has conquered Satan. Satan was the master of human beings. But Christ came to do battle with our master. He's defeated the king who claimed to own us, to subject us. And now all that belongs to Satan belongs to Jesus. For Satan is a defeated foe. Everything that was Satan's property is Christ's property. But many won't believe that yet. Not even those who attend church will believe that Satan is defeated. For let him go on and on claiming victory in their lives when Christ is the one who's already conquered. And the Lord says to us in Christianity, "I have won you in battle. You belong to me. I claim you as my spoils, my prize, a warfare. Will you acknowledge that you belong to me?" For it's still a choice, even though He's won. "I have won you." In addition to that, He says, "I have redeemed you with my precious blood. As though you're the property of Satan, I bought you from him to be mine." So by creation, original ownership, by redemption, buying you, by winning in battle, conquering you, by these three methods, He says, "You're mine. Will you love me and serve me because you are mine?" That is a decision that the Christian church offers to everyone today. And the King of Kings today asks just one question. Have I won you yet? Have I won you yet? And every day as you awaken, you must decide, has He won me? Has He won my heart? Has He won my affections? Has He won my time? Has He won my interest? Has He won my money? Has He won my family? Has He won my future? Has He won my plans? Has He won all my interests? Has He won all my heart? Has He won me? He says He has. His word says He has. What do you say? We sing the song, "You know, He's won my heart at last." All you have to do is acknowledge the truth. Christ is King of Kings. He has won everything. And very soon He's coming to claim all who acknowledge that He's won them. He wants you to be in that precious group. This is our God. There is no other. He's God of gods. This is our King. We have waited for Him and He will save us. May the Lord help you to this day to realize that Christ has conquered you. He's conquered Satan. He's conquered every enemy. That you're His precious prize. And He wants you desperately. Give Him your heart.